This is Janet Levine for the National Park Service, and I'm here today. I'm here today in Margate, Florida, at the home of Shirley Rothman. I'm here with Lillian Lieberman Levine and Shirley Lieberman Rothman, who are sisters, who came from Poland in 1921 when Lillian was 11 and Shirley was 13 years old. Today is April 26th, 1993, and this is a return engagement since the tape recorder was not functioning completely well on our first interview, which was on May 10th, 1992. Well, I'm very happy to have the chance to talk with you both again, and we'll try to fill in, then we'll see if there's something new that we and then we even mentioned last time new that we didn't even mention. Nathan Levine, Lillian Levine's husband, is also here with Dean. Lillian Levine's husband is also here with us today in Margate. Okay. Maybe just for the beginning of this tape too, if you would say your birth dates and where in Poland you were born.
Well, I'm not so happy to repeat the birth date, but you know, as it says in the first tape, that was sometime in February 1910, I believe, and I was born in Ostrów Mazowieck, Poland. And Shirley?
And I'm Shirley. I was 13 when we arrived in this country. In January of 1921, and I too was born in Ostrów Mazowieck, Łomża Gubernia. I'll add that because it's part of our address, and we are here today to answer any questions or relate any stories of our life.
Okay, why don't we start with stories about your grandfather, because I know he was very important to you, and I think that in the first tape there was a gap in some of the stories. So if you can just think of any experiences with your grandfather prior to you leaving.
Well, I can recall that he was a great help to my mother, packing things together, and he was running back and forth from his house to our apartment, and also that when we didn't feel well, we used to come to him, and he had methods of curing a sore throat, toothaches, which I don't recall the toothaches actually, but if anybody needed that, I suppose he was able to help that too. This is my recollection, and there are other recollections, but I don't know exactly where to begin. So Shirley may have something to add.
Well, I know that we loved our grandfather a great deal. He was part of our life, and like Lillian said, he had methods of helping any illness that we had as children. Without a medical degree, he knew exactly what to do. If I had a sore throat, he would come in with a teaspoon and squeeze out the pus from my tonsil, and I would get better the very next day. But the most important part, I don't know whether you want me to repeat that story when we left Ostrava, or should we leave that for later?
When you left?
Yes.
The story when you left?
Yeah.
Well, it's a poignant story.
Yeah. Is there something you want to talk about before we do this?
No, it's already on the tape. I don't know if you want to repeat that.
Janet says she wants to make a new tape.
Why? I think.
Tell about his business upstairs that he had. That
maybe employed. First also his name.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Tell about his business upstairs that he employed your uncle and everybody there.
My grandfather's name was Shlomo Kwiatek.
Can you spell it?
Yeah, I will spell the name Kwiatek. Kwiatek. We have one relative in this country who still maintains that name. His sons, who were my uncles, all changed their name when they came to America. They all changed their name to Bloom, which means Kwiatek. Kwiatek means flower, and so they changed it to Bloom. They wanted to be Americanized, and they used that name. I prefer the name Kwiatek because it's unusual and different, but my uncles didn't feel that way. Is there anything else you want to add, Lou?
I don't know what Janet wants. I really don't have any idea what you want us to say, except our grandfather was the father figure. He was instead of a father, and because our father was in America, and when he wasn't in America, he was very little at home. So he represented the father figure, and we loved him dearly, and and he was very devoted to us. So that's, repeat the story. I don't know, you wanted Shirley to repeat the story about when we left in that cold night for America. If you want that repeated, I think Shirley tells it best, so I'll let her do that.
This is one memory in my life that I will never forget, and it's the saddest memory because we all loved my grandfather, like we have already said, and we had to leave to come to this country. We had to leave and make a train going to Warsaw, and we had to leave at about in the middle of the night, 2-3 o'clock in the morning. And it was in the mid-December, and it was very, very cold. It was bitter cold, but it was a beautiful night where the moon was shining and the snow and the ice were glistening. And my grandfather got up, and he helped us get onto the carriage. It was an open platform, like a truck, which was drawn by horses, to help us carry our belongings onto that and to say goodbye to us for the last time because he knew he would never see us again. And he helped us on, and the carriage or the truck started moving away, and he was running after it and crying, and it was so sad, and we all cried, and I will never, never forget this.
Very warm here.
Want me to put on the fan?
Maybe just in summarizing, before we leave your life in Poland, how would you describe your life in Poland prior to leaving for the United States? Just kind of.
Some memories come back very fast, and one of these memories, I believe, we did not cover, did not say anything about on the first tape, and that was the time when war broke out in Europe, and the battles were coming closer and closer to where we lived. We all had to get into a cellar in order to have some security from the bombs or from the bullets or from the guns. And that's where we stayed all night. And when we finally did get out, it was very early in the morning, and lots of people piled into our small two-room apartment. And we all stretched out on wherever we could find a space. I guess the children were put into bed, and the others stayed wherever they could in that two-room apartment. This is very vivid. I can recall that. But even more vivid is the time when the war was already in progress for quite a number of years, and there was an air raid in the town. We had an air raid, and we again had to get into the cellar. We got into the cellar, but this time we did not close doors because we knew that the raid would have short duration. We left the doors open, whereas in the first time when we got into the cellars, all the doors were locked very tight, two sets of doors, one up on top, one on the bottom. But this particular one, the one that I wanted to tell about, is when we did not lock the doors, and when the air raid sirens went off, there were two people that ran into our cellar, two Polish people, a man and a woman. shortly thereafter, some Polish soldiers came to that cellar, and they saw us all assembled there. And they were very suspicious, and they accused us of being spies, and they pointed their guns at us. They were going to kill everybody in there. But luckily, we had those two Polish people there. The man was an anti-Semite, and he said, shoot them all. They're no good. They're all Jews, and shoot them all. The woman, on the other hand, was very sympathetic, and she got on her knees, and she pleaded with them, and she said, these are innocent people. We ran in from the street. She thought that we had run in from the street, which we had not, but that's what she thought. And leave them alone, and leave us alone. We are innocent people. She pleaded so long until they finally they left us alone, and they went away. But our lives were very much in danger at that time. The guns were pointed right at us. This I'll never forget. This is one memory that I'll never forget. In fact, I told this very story to my third grade class when I was here such a short time, but my teacher asked questions, and I answered that question by telling that story. And I think the little girls and the little boys in that class were very much concerned and very interested in that story. So that's my story. Now, is there anything else, Janet, that you would like to know? Shirley may have something to say about this.
We'll be talking about leaving Poland. So if there's anything...
Shirley, do you want to add anything to that story?
Yes, I remember it very clearly, too. And I remember being so frightened and so scared that I wanted to, like, creep into the wall. And when we finally, when this woman, she crossed herself and begged these men, she said, these are innocent people who ran away from the bullets. There was an air raid or something. And we heard the bullets being shot at us. And so when we finally got out of that cellar and went into the house, I remember I threw up everything I ever ate in my life, because from fright I was so scared that I didn't know what, and I was like sick for the rest of the day. Those are the things that we went through many times. We lived in that cellar a lot during the war, because there were attacks, all kinds of attacks. Until the Germans took over, we had all kinds of battles going on in that little town where we lived. So we lived through this a lot. We were in the cellar a lot, trying to hide. That was the only place where we felt safe, that the bullets wouldn't reach us. And this is what we had to go through during our young days.
Were there other incidents of anti-Semitism?
There were quite a few. Yes, there were. Yes, I remember one time we went berry picking in the woods, my mother and all of us children, I think. I remember you and I, Lil, were there, and we took along bread and something to drink, and so we spent most of the day picking berries, and I remember we filled up a whole bucket full of berries. And we were on our way home going on the road, and some Polish boys saw us, and they attacked us, and they spilled our berries all over the road. The Polish people, unfortunately, I have to say, were very anti-Semitic. They didn't like the Jews, which is too bad, because we were very peace-loving and just trying to get along. We didn't want much from them. But these are the kind of things that last in your mind, you know, you can remember.
Mm-hmm. What was the composition of the town? Was it about half and half as far as Jewish and Gentile, or was it more of a difference in the balance?
Go ahead. Well, I would say that the town, the main streets of the town, were more or less Jewish, more Jewish. The Polish people were mostly farmers,
and they were around
the town. But the Jewish people lived within the town. They had small businesses, a grocery store, or a a bakery or a ready-to-wear store or kind of thing, shoe store, like Ben was in the shoe store. And but the Jewish people lived in the town, the Polish outside of the town.
Can you describe the house where you lived?
Yes, of course. It was, actually, there were more than one apartments. I think they had about three or four apartments in that particular area of the building. Ours, you had to walk up about four steps. It was just a two-room apartment. The living room, the dining room, the bedroom was all in one room. And then there was a kitchen, which was large living room, dining room, bedroom. The kitchen was sort of a narrow, long, the same length, the whole length of the apartment. And we had, I think it was coal that we used to use, or wood, for heating. And the oven part that you open up to put the wood in was in the kitchen. And on the other side of the wall was the place where you got a lot of heat. There were tiles, white or some colored tiles. I think they were white mostly. And that wall became very warm. And that's, we used to stand up against that to get some warmth. And we had all the furniture we needed, I suppose, two big beds where we shared. That's all. My mother and two children slept in one, and we slept in the other, Shirley and I, and occasionally there were other people sleeping with us. My mother's brother, my mother's brother-in-law, which was, I think, the wrong thing to do, but that we didn't know about those things, and certainly not I, and I hope my mother didn't either, because she shouldn't have allowed that, I feel. But anyhow, that's the way it was, and the four chairs were around the table. And if we should see someone coming to visit, we were four girls, and we didn't want anybody to sit on those chairs. So if we saw someone come in toward the, from the street, we would run into the house, and we would sit on the chairs. We vied with one another. We did not want anyone to take our chair. So we came and we sat, the people who came to visit. I don't know what they did, because we wouldn't give up the chairs.
We'll shut pause it. Here.
I talked about it.
Okay, we're resuming now after a phone call. Okay, so you were sitting in the chair so that the visitors couldn't.
Yeah, that's right. And until my mother, of course, would tell us to kindly get up and give a seat to the... but we had our chairs... You could have printed our name on it because we were always in the same chair. But I wanted to add, as she, Lillian explained about the heating system that we had. The stove was in the open part of the oven, was in the kitchen where it was fed with wood and heated the whole apartment. On the other side, in the other room, was the tile wall, which got hot from the... But we also had like a Pripyatchuk. You may have heard that word. It was part of the oven that's flat of the wall. And we used to be able to sit on that and warm up. Yeah.
Was the stove like a range?
That was different, no. We had a kitchen range, which also was fed by wood. But this was a heating system, which had like a little... door on top where you could put food in to warm a part, you know, like a little closet up on top, a cabinet where you can put in things to warm. And the whole wall on the other side got all heated up so that it heated the second room. And this was our heating system. For cooking, we had another kind, also fed by wood. We had no electricity or anything like that.
What did you use for lighting?
We had kerosene lamps, one kerosene lamp in the whole big room.
And during the war, candles.
Yeah, that's right. And we had to do our homework by that light when we went to school. I went to school and Lillian went for a while also.
About the lighting system that we had, as Shirley said, the kerosene was, of course, probably the most effective. But during the war... must have had a shortage of kerosene, and we had to use candles, and candles were scarce too. And there was one family who lived upstairs. Their name was Abramchik, and Hannah was my friend. They had no candles, and they had no kerosene, and they had no lamps, and they had no food either, for that matter. And I recall we felt so sorry for them. We were poor ourselves, but they were even worse off. So we used to take the tallow that would melt from the candles. I remember that very distinctly. And we would put a thread into the soft tallow and roll it to make a candle out of it and bring it up to them. That's exactly how I remember it.
Yeah,
and it was,
I remember that too.
The
from the overflow of the tallow, we'd use it again. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, how about your cousins? They lived nearby?
Yeah, they lived right across. We had, as I think I explained in the first tape, that we were right off a very large square, so, and the buildings were all around in a square. We lived at the, let's say, the south side, and they lived on the east side of that square. I used to go there for the lessons that Rose used to give me. I went there quite often because it was a daily thing, I guess, in those, when I couldn't go to school. So I went there often, and I knew that apartment very well. But they came to us. Mostly they came to us. Ours was the meeting ground. And everyone was always welcome at our house. I guess it was my mother's attitude toward children and towards her family. And they used to come to us. I remember that also again during the war. Those were the most vivid memories. Rose and Sylvia used to come Friday night. And after the candles went out, we used to sing mostly sad songs. Those were my recollections. Rose had a beautiful voice, and Sylvia had a beautiful voice, but Rose was even more beautiful. And we sang Polish songs from the war, and they knew so much Polish, and we were able to join in, and we sang Yiddish songs, and the atmosphere in the dark, it was very plaintive. I remember it was so sad. And we got to know them so much better. They came so often. We were always very close. And I think Shirley may be able to add a few things herself.
I just want to say that, you know, this family, our cousins and my aunt Esther and her family, who had six children, her husband also was in America. He left Europe, our country, Europe, to come to America when the war broke out, because none of the boys wanted to be in the army. So they all left, my father and my uncle, and they all went to the... But I want to tell you the way we lived, to give you an idea of the way we lived. My aunt, who had six children, lived in one room. I don't know how they slept. I can't imagine how they slept. She and six children were living in one room. Also, Lillian told you that they used to come to us all the time because, I don't know, well, they had one room, we had two rooms, and my mother, of course, always invited people to come. They used to come on Friday night and Saturday, all day Saturday, we'd sit and sing songs. And, in fact, Sylvia, who was the younger of the girls, she was the second girl, second youngest in the family. She slept in our house a lot. She slept with us. She slept with Lillian and me. We were two in the bed. She was the third. There was always a third in the bed. And she got very ill at one time. I think we spoke about it during our first recording, that she got typhus, and she got very ill. She had a very high temperature, and her mother or the whole family did not want to put her in the hospital because they did not trust the hospitals or any of the care that was given to the six people in the hospital during the war. They really didn't care much about civilians. So we had to hide the fact that she was ill, and they had to get her out of our house so that we shouldn't be infected with that disease. So they carried her at night. They took her out of the house. They carried her in a blanket across the square. And to her aunt's house, who had an apartment somewhere also off the square. And on the way, they dropped her into the snow. But anyway, she was carried to that house. They put her in a room by herself, which must have been 0 degrees, but I think that's what helped her sickness. That cold room, and she was wrapped up in blankets, and she, of course, survived and got better, and she was okay. But at least we had to get her out of our house so that our 4 children should not be infected. I later on got it anyway, but I don't know whether it was through her or some other source. But anyway, what I want to stress very much is the closeness that we were with that family. We didn't consider them like cousins. They were almost like sisters. They were part of us. Whatever we did, we always did together. They're sisters and brothers. They were 6, and we were 4.
What were their names?
Rose was the oldest. Then came Sylvia. Then came David. Then Madeline. And Saul. Saul was the young. There's a little.
There were only 5, by the way. There were only 5, by the way, not 6. The 6th one must have died quite some time earlier before I can remember.
Okay, we're resuming now again.
Was there something
that you wanted to add about your cousins? You had mentioned about them earlier.
Well, I don't want to miss David, because David was very, very close, devoted friend and cousin. We were very close to him and loved him. He loved us. Shirley was his friend, and they used to socialize.
I was closest in age to him, that's why.
Yes. And I, of course, he was not in his company because I was maybe a couple of years younger. But he shared with us all his knowledge. As soon as he used to go to Cheder, and as soon as he learned something in Cheder, he would come over and teach us. He taught me the alphabet in Yiddish, how to write it and how to read it. And to this day, I can still read and write Jewish, all thanks to David, whom I miss very much, I must say, because I really was very fond of David. And Madeline was my very close friend. She took me into the Madison house. That was a settlement house, which was at 214 Madison. She lived at 216, and we lived at 214. We lived at 212, and the Madison house was at 216.
Madison Street.
Yes, that was Madison Street. Madison
this
house.
This is New York. Now.
This is in the lower. This is the Lower East Side, and when we moved finally to the Lower East Side from the Bronx, it must have been, Madeline became my very dear friend. She introduced me to all her friends. By then, she had made some, and there was a club, and she took me into the club as a member, and we had about 15 or 20 girls in that very club, and we were always very, very friendly. We had lots of fun. But Madeline was my dearest friend. Now, of course, she lives in Miami Beach, and she has other interests and other friends, and we do see each other occasionally and speak to each other more often, but I still recall our dearest friendship, and that was with Madeline.
And you were your friendship.
No, Madeline was not friendly. No, Madeline was not friendly in Poland with us at all. The only ones that we saw in that family were Rose, whom we loved, Sylvia, whom we loved, and David, whom we loved. They were our dearest friends, dearest cousins. They came to America with us. So that we were never without them. We were always together. But now we're without them, unfortunately. But that's not anything that we could have done anything about.
David was a... He didn't have a very long formal education, but he was very well educated in Hebrew. And he became a director of a Hebrew school in Teaneck, New Jersey. I think it's comparable to the principal. Wouldn't you say that, Lil?
Yes.
Yeah. And he became very active with helping Israel. And he went to Israel many, many times. And he finally died in Israel. And I think that was the place where he should have ended his life, because Israel was his love. He did a great deal of work for Israel, helped them. He went at least a dozen times. He'd speak to me or be in my house on Thursday, Saturday. He was in Israel. He couldn't tell me that he was going, or he couldn't tell anybody. It was a secret, because he did certain things for Israel that could not be spoken about.
He died in Israel.
He died in Israel. And at that time, one of our other cousins was connected with CBS. He was a reporter.
I guess so.
Yeah, he reported the news from Israel. His name was Danny Bloom. He was my Uncle Joe's son, younger son. And he was there at the time when David came to Israel. He always contacted him because he worked for CBS and he had a lot of things, you know, that he can do. So Danny, of course, when David died, Danny called the family from Israel to tell them what happened. And, of course, it was a very sad time for all of us. I, unfortunately, was in Florida at the time, right after a very serious illness, and I could not come. They would not allow me to go to New York for the funeral, and that I regret a great deal.
I was there at the funeral, and some very nice things were said about David. He was a very unusual person. He had so much knowledge. Never mind the education formally. He had so much knowledge. He was so well informed that education couldn't have done much more for him if he had a degree in whatever.
Maybe you could say something about the attitude of your family and also your cousins about education and about learning.
Well, it was important, but unfortunately, other things were even more important. Supporting the family was very important, so that not get enough time for did not get enough time for education. I had to go to work as soon as possible when I was 16 years old. I did get some training, of course, in a business school for which my mother paid, and I got some jobs doing office work and also became very proficient at that and made nice salaries. But education was never out of the picture. It was always very important, especially to me. It was always very important.
Well, the reason that we couldn't afford to go to school was because my father abandoned us, so we had no one to support us. So that as soon as we reached the age of 16, and when we came to this country, someone had to guarantee that we would not become a public charge, that would not go on welfare, which is now known as welfare, so that someone had to guarantee this. And one of my uncles finally got his boss to sign for us that we would not be a public charge. So as soon as we became old enough, we had to go to work to support the rest of the family. And that's why we couldn't get any education. When I was 16, I left there. I had to go to school until I was 16. So, and then I went on to night high school. I used to go to school at night and work during the day so that I can bring in some money for the family to live on. My mother tried very hard, but she had four young children to take care of, and she couldn't leave us all alone. So she did work at home. I remember we used to help her. She used to go and get work. At that time, they had people taking homework. We did all kinds of things at home to make some money, but as soon as we were 16, we had to go to work, and we could not continue with any education. Of course, we always tried. We read, and we tried to learn, but we don't have formal degrees.
What was your mother's name and maiden name?
My mother's name was Malke K. Kwiatkowiak. That was her maiden name. She married a man named Saul Mendel Lieberman, which was arranged. The marriage, of course, was arranged. She was introduced. She never went out with him on dates like as we are accustomed to. She met him maybe once, looked at him, and then after a certain proper time, there was an engagement, which is in Hebrew, Noyim. And after that, they got married and they lived together. My father was a carpenter, or I would say he was more like
a master
carpenter, like a cabinet maker. But we lived in such a small town, he could not find work, so he always had to go away to find a job. Father really didn't have much of a father, but my mother filled both parts very beautifully. She was wonderful. We never had any problems.
Is there anything else that you would say about life in Poland before we talk about leaving there?
Well, mostly I can recall during the war, because prior to that I was probably too young to remember very much. I do remember, however, when my father did leave for the United States, I was not very old, I must say, but I must have been 3 years old.
I recall
grabbing at his leg for him not to go. I don't know whether he was going to America or not. He may have been going on a job, but I recall grabbing at his leg and trying to hold him down. He shouldn't leave. I guess we had an affection for him. Don't have that recollection as I grew older, but that's the only one that I do remember. And during the war, there were so many trials and tribulations. My mother had to do a lot of smuggling to make ends meet. One day she told me, while the Germans occupied our town, the Germans occupied our town for quite a while, I believe. They stayed until the Russian Revolution, probably, or probably till 1918 when they signed the treaty in November 11th, 1918. But I do recall this incident. My mother was smuggling some flour or sugar or whatever it was, and she told me to watch out for the German policeman. He was the chief of police, and he used to wear a cape. And they used to call him, everybody had some kind of a name other than his given name. They called him the Polerine. In Jewish, that means the cape. My mother said to me, "You stand on this place." There was a sort of a little bit of water that used to run through the town. I don't know what it was. They called it a rough. A rough is, I don't know what.
A canal.
It was a very, very narrow canal.
Yeah.
I remember that very well. And there was a wooden bridge that was level with the ground, because the canal was depressed and the wooden bridge was on top. And my mother said, "You stand on that bridge, and if you see him, tell me that he's coming in me. Tell me that he's coming and I should go in another direction." I was standing there, and I did finally see my mother coming from the left and the Polerine coming from the same direction. I said, "What am I going to do?" So quickly I decided, if I move, I'll attract attention. I stayed there, glued. And my mother saw that what was happening, and she realized that he was right behind her, and she quickly ran into some kind of a store or another one of the teos. That's what I recalled them. And that's how she was saved from punishment. But this incident also stands out very clearly in my mind. I think I've mentioned it a few times to my husband. He said no, but I think I thought I did.
What was the word you used? Teas?
The tea. Yeah. What do you call that? A tea?
It's like the entrance to a fort. Those big wooden doors.
Yeah, well, each court had this type of entrance. We called it the Taya. I don't know what you call it here. It's just the entrance to
to the place where you live.
But it's large.
Oh, very large.
Well, to us it was large. It may not have been as large as we thought. We were small, so to us it was enormous.
In that very same theater, we used to do all sorts of things. We used to play there. And one time we made stilts for ourselves, and we walked on stilts.
Right.
I remember that was one of the things, how we played. At one time you asked us how we played.
Yes.
And we did that. We made the stilts, and we walked on stilts to see how well we can walk on stilts. And that's how we enjoyed our...
We had no toys ever to play with. So whatever we had to make it ourselves. Like I told you once before, I never had a doll, or neither one of us, none of us ever had a doll. So we had to make one. I think in a way it was good, because we used our imagination, we used our skill. Like she said, to make the stilts, we had seen them somewhere, maybe, I don't know how we knew about it, and so we repeated, we copied, and we used our imagination. We took pieces of wood and made stilts, and we walked on stilts.
And then we kept our balance. It took a little while, I guess, to really keep it well for a longer period of time. But it did develop that we were doing that quite well.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you could describe the courtyard with the families around it.
Oh, yes.
What that was.
I'll tell you. I think Oz was the only one with a Taya.
What is that?
The entrance. Because we lived in what was the city hall. The same place where the city hall, there was a big brick building. It was the city hall, and it had an entrance like, I would say, like the entrance to a palace. Big wooden doors, and you came into like through a grand entrance, an enormous foyer with these great big wooden doors that opened up. And the floor of that foyer was all wood, and there was the entrance to the city hall, and then on the left side was the entrance to a store, a fabric store.
Outside?
No, on the inside also. They had an entrance on the inside. And then you came through these doors and through that foyer, and there was a big courtyard, and it was surrounded by buildings. There was... one big brick building, in which the rich person of the town who owned the store on the main street lived, and the young girl was my friend. Her name was Hadassah. Then there was another tenant, and then there was a bakery in the basement, and then there was a wooden buildings. And which my grandfather and grandmother lived, and my grandfather had a little factory upstairs, a tanning factory. Then there were the outhouses and stalls for the animals. And then around the other side, there was another building in which we lived, and two tenants upstairs. And then there was an entrance to that woman with the cards. What was her name? Who played cards? She had the store, and she lived in back of the store. And this was the courtyard, and it was all cobblestones.
Yes, cobblestones.
Right, and this is where we lived, and we had two rooms. My grandmother and grandfather had two rooms, and the little factory upstairs where he had. Three or four young boys working for him. And I remember when I was very small, after my father left and we moved to that courtyard, we had been living somewhere else, but when my father left, my mother wanted to be close to her folks, and so we moved into that courtyard. And I remember going upstairs, and there was this big vat with the leather in a big vat with certain brine, and I wanted to look in, and I fell into it. So that was really funny, and the boys that worked there, some of them was not so nice to me anyway. I don't want to really say anything about that. It wasn't nice. I was only about 6 years old.
There were lots of neighbors we had. We used to have the children in this very court, and we used to play with them. We used to have games and play with them, and subsequently I became very friendly with this Hannah, like I mentioned her before, Hannah Bramchik, and she went to school with me. And when I got the measles, she continued to go to school, and at that time they gave out wooden shoes to the children, wooden sole shoes to the children in school. And since I had the measles, I didn't get the shoes, and I'll never forget how awful I felt because I didn't get the shoes. They were clopping around with the shoes, and I couldn't clop around with the shoes. So I felt very neglected and very, but they didn't have another pair of shoes to give me. So I was very unlucky when I had the measles. I was very sick when I had the measles. It's a terrible disease, and I'm glad to hear that they have now some anti-things for measles.
But what I want to say is that we had no doctor in town.
What did you have, like?
We had what is called a fellowship. He was like a pharmacist, and we had a pharmacy, and he substituted for the doctor. Well, we didn't have a doctor in town, although during the war, I think there was a hospital there. Wasn't there a hospital?
It must have had one.
Yeah, but we didn't have a doctor that we can call on if a child got sick. I remember my sister Esther, she got scarlet fever, and she almost died, and we hadn't. No way of doing anything.
That's
for
That's right,
her.
And it's yeah. amazing, really.
Yeah.
It's amazing that we were all living in such small quarters,
yeah.
such close quarters, that all of us didn't get these diseases. Shirley had the typhus, which is not typhoid fever; it's entirely different. The typhus is a much more serious disease. I didn't
Very
get it. The rest of us didn't get it. Esther had this. A scarlet fever, which it was treated for something else. She needed to be treated with heat, and the doctor, who was a German woman, came in and treated her with ice packs. And she was about 3 years old,
yeah.
and she almost died. And my grandfather came in to see if she was living or dead, and he put a feather under her nose to see if she was breathing. That's how sick she was, but she recovered just naturally. And I guess by the grace of God.
Did people die very often? I mean, were you aware of people dying because there was no medical, real medical attention?
I remember that Dreje's little daughter
yeah.
died of scarlet fever
yeah.
just before Esther got better.
Yeah.
That little girl died. She was also probably about 5-6 years old.
We were really not aware of death.
Not too much.
No. We were too young to even know, you know, to mm-hmm. think about it.
But
know?
I do remember this child dying
yeah.
in the
right.
same court where we lived.
Well, also, from malnutrition, the children suffered a great deal. Lillian was one of them. She had such infections on her scalp. That with big blisters of pus all over her head from malnutrition because she didn't get the proper food. All we lived on was potatoes and bread when we had it. So it was really, an orange was when you were dying, you got an orange, you know.
Well, you had to be very sick.
Yeah, you had to be very sick to deserve an orange.
Or, for that matter, chicken soup was also
yeah.
scarce. Everything
right.
was scarce.
So she was very ill with all those infections.
Oh, my hair fell out on that side where I had. Yeah. I remember it was this side, the right side. It was all covered with pus,
and
Sylvia got that later.
Yeah.
And when we were going to America, Sylvia still had a little bald spot right there, where
yeah.
she had it. But her hair was already growing, so the doctors did not take too much notice of it. But she got it also because we were all malnourished.
Yeah.
And here, too, in this country, when I was 13 years old, I think I weighed 78 pounds. So I was eligible to go to a camp for deprived children. And I went there because I qualified with my weight.
Mm-hmm.
And so I benefited that way because I loved the place. Madeline and I both went there. We had such a great time.
What'd you call the name of it?
The name of the place was called Felicia. Later on, after we were growing older, 14, 15, we were able to go to Camp Madison, and that was a charge. in Felicia, we paid $3 for the 2 weeks. My mother paid that. And the next time, I think we had to pay $5 for 2 weeks for each child. And then my sisters, Esther and Sylvia, went also. Through the Madison House, they arranged all these things. Uh-huh. It was a settlement house where we learned a great deal.
Let's talk about that. Let's first talk about how was it that it was decided that you and your sisters and mother would come to America?
Well, my father sent for us. He sent money. The war ended, and he sent us money. I guess there was some correspondence between mother and father, and he sent us $500 and we had applied to come to America, and that's how it was. We were, I guess it was always intended that the family would be joined together. And he certainly wasn't coming back to Poland, so we were going to America. And that's how we did it. We came to America. We decided to go to America to be with my mother, her husband, and we with our father. But it didn't work out the way we had originally planned. And I think we spoke about that on the first tape, when my father was ill in the hospital and resumed a relationship probably with a young woman whom he had relationship prior to our coming, and he had second thoughts about taking on such a big responsibility, a wife, four children. There was no apartment. He didn't get us an apartment. He was still in the hospital, and we sort of wandered around for a while among the relatives. Shirley was one cousin of my father's, although my father was the one who did not wish to start a life together. His cousins were very sympathetic, and cousin Morris Bloom took Shirley, Morris Bloom and Bertha Bloom took Shirley to live with. I went with my Uncle Joe and Aunt Becky to live with them until we could establish a place that my Uncle Joe was on my mother's side. But my mother went with my father's cousin with two children, and that was a very big... I can only say that was a big sacrifice on their part to take in three people when they themselves had three children in a two-bedroom apartment. But they were the ones who were sympathetic and believed that my father should have done it, but as long as he didn't, they took us in.
I just want to emphasize the fact that when my mother and we came to this country, into a strange land, with strangers all around us. My father was ill, and we had to be separated, and the family had to be separated. It was the most painful time in our lives. I went to live with my father's cousins, whom I never saw in my life. She went to live with an aunt and uncle whom she never saw in her life. The two younger children, of course, went with my mother, so they were a little bit more secure. But we suffered painfully to be separated from the rest of the family and have to live with strangers. It was a very terrible time. And I lived with them
About 3 months
until my mother, my uncles were able to find an apartment for us on the Lower East Side on Henry Street, 37 Henry Street, on the fifth floor, and we all... a bedroom, living room, and kitchen, three rooms, and it had a toilet in the house, which was a great advantage. Just a toilet, no bath or anything. And we moved down there, and we started going to school in PS1.
We transferred to PS1 because originally we were in PS40 in the Bronx, and I went from my teacher, whom I cannot forget either. Her name was Reese, Miss Reese, and she was a doll. She, I think, mentioned that on the tape. I hate to be repetitive, but
okay.
Should I repeat the story? Well, she was very sweet to me, I guess. She asked me to tell the story when I was able to speak a little bit, so I did tell that story, which I mentioned earlier. And when I had to leave, I had to be transferred out of the school from her class. She embraced me, and she kissed me. I thought that was, when looking back upon it now, I have not seen a teacher do this, and nor have I ever heard anybody doing this. Teachers don't do this. She was very demonstrative. She embraced me. She kissed me. And I said, goodbye, children. That was my experience in PS 40. And I still remember that because it was pleasant. It was very pleasant. I learned to speak. I learned to read. She was very proud of me reading. I came from Poland, and I could read Polish very well. So I came here and read the same sort of alphabet. And I read here probably very wrongly, but she told me to read in front of other teachers. I didn't know what I was reading, but I was reading. I read very well. I guess I could have said Jack and Jill. Jack, I can't imagine how I could have said Jack, because the C and the K in Polish are pronounced. It's not a K altogether, but I must have been able to read other things, because she always told me to read in front of teachers. And this was when I was here only a short time. So she was a very understanding person. She was young. She was young and very beautiful. I loved her. And she must have been a very good teacher. She let me go to the other kids, other children's benches or seats when I couldn't understand her the first day or two. I was very, very unhappy. I didn't understand one single word. And she did not mind my getting up to sit next to another Jewish child who I knew could speak some Yiddish. And I asked her, what did she say and what is going on in this classroom? So she never stopped me from going out of my seat and into this other child's seat. And I think she was a lovely teacher, and I wish there were more like her.
Well, I too had the same experience as far as understanding the language. I didn't know any English at all. And when I got into, they put me, according to my age, they put me, I think, in the fifth grade. But they might have put me in any grade, because I didn't understand. I was like deaf and dumb. I could not understand what they were saying. And then when I was transferred, finally, when we moved to the Lower East Side and we started going to PS1, I began to understand some English and be able to speak. But I had a problem, I think, over there I was okay with the arithmetic already. I had a problem with arithmetic in the earlier grades, but I finally mastered that. But I, too, had a wonderful teacher, one teacher, a Miss Adler, who wanted me to continue going to school during the day after I graduated. At that time, we used to go to the eighth grade, not like now where you, from the sixth, you go to junior and so on. At that time, the elementary school was through the eighth grade. So when I was ready to graduate, she wanted me to go on to day high school, and she said she would try to get me a scholarship. Would I go? I said, I can't. I have to start working and supporting and helping support the family. And I couldn't. I had to go to night school. But she was the one who really was very understanding also and very helpful in my school at life, in my life at school. There was another teacher who was very mean. She was horrible. But anyway, I graduated with honors, and everything was just fine.
Were you treated badly as far as being greenhorns or being immigrants in any ways?
I don't remember anything. Do you? I don't remember.
Yes, I remember that the children used to say, oh, you're a greenhorn, or I said, oh, were you born in Boston? At that time, I guess I spoke with a broad A, because that's how I read English, and I still speak that way. So they very often they would say, were you born in Boston? They would ask me that question, but they did say greenhorn. I recall being not called maybe, but I heard the word very often. I'm not sure if it was applied to me specifically, but I did hear the word, and I don't think it bothered me very much anyway.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Getting back to before you got here, the voyage itself, do you remember your feelings about being in steerage on the boat?
Well, the only thing, I didn't really care that we were in steerage. I didn't know any different. So wherever they put us was okay with us. I mean, we were never used to any luxuries. We were, you know, as I said before, very poor, and we didn't know the different. But the only thing that I remember, I was already 13, and our cousins Rose and Sylvia were traveling with us, and they were older. And they, of course, maybe were flirting, and there were some women from Czechoslovakia who were married women coming here to meet their husbands. But they were not very nice. I remember how I was introduced to sex on the boat, on the ship. I remember waking up during the night. I might have gone to bed early. I don't know what time it was, maybe 11, 12 o'clock at night. And these women were with the stewards. We were all sleeping in a big dormitory, maybe 500 people in one room. And these women, stewards, the sailors, were sleeping with those women, and they were having sex with them. And the lights were on, and everybody was yelling and applauding while they were having sex. This was my introduction to sex. That's just how I didn't know what they were doing, but someone, I think my cousin explained it to me. I didn't know what it was.
I remember seeing that also, but I did not know exactly what was happening. Anyhow, I was seasick throughout on the first tape.
Yeah?
The first tape it was. But
that story is on the first tape.
Okay, we're resuming now. We ran out of the first tape. Now this is tape two. And I'm talking with Shirley Rothman and Lillian Levine. And we'll continue talking about the voyage.
Okay. Well, I think that we were at the kinds of foods that were offered to us. We were on mostly, since we were on a Holland-American line, and I think we mentioned the name of the ship. If it didn't get on the first tape, we'll repeat that. It was the SS Rindam. I think it spells R-I-I. N-D-A-M. There may be some... Shirley thinks it's another spelling, but it can be checked out. And whichever it is, it is the Rindam pronounced that way. Anyhow, what I started to say was that the food consisted mostly of herring. I guess that's the national food of the Dutch people. So we were fed herring a lot. I don't recall any other food because I was not very interested in eating anyway since I was seasick. Excuse me. But you wanted to know about the voyage. It was very stormy, very severe. The ship was rocking and rolling, and it was really a very, very rough voyage. One time I went upstairs to the lavatory, and I wanted to see what it looked like on the outside, because being downstairs in the steerage, there were no windows, and we really did not know. We might have even been below sea level, for all I know. And so I stood up on the toilet seat. I wanted to see what was going on outside, and I quickly ran down because it was so frightening. There were two huge waves, one on either side of the ship, black water. And I was frightened from that, and I said, my goodness gracious, this is very, very rough and very dangerous. So I quickly left the area and went down to my bed and lay down again.
Well, to emphasize about the scariness of the ship, when I was not as sick as she and my mother and the other children were. I was walking around with my two cousins, Rose and Sylvia, and we went up on the deck. And it was so frightening. Like Lillian said, two black walls, and the ship looked like a speck on the bottom, that any minute we would be absorbed into this ocean. So I ran down, and I was scared, and I never went up on deck again until we reached New York Harbor. But as far as the food is concerned, we were being cheated all the time. They ripped us off wherever, as soon as we started, as soon as we came to Warsaw, they started ripping us off from all directions. My mother was told that each and every one of us had glaucoma. We had to be treated for glaucoma, which was no such thing. We were healthy children and she was healthy. We were told we had all kinds of diseases that we had to be treated for. And the same cheating went on for, as long as we were in Warsaw, until my mother finally got all her papers and we were able to leave. We had to travel to Rotterdam, all through a good portion of Europe. We went through Germany and until we got to Rotterdam. And we finally, when we did get on the ship and we were supposed to get certain kinds of food, all we got was herring, and they stole the rest of it and put it away, and they were selling it. The stewards were selling it. So my two cousins, Rose and Sylvia, and a friend of theirs, a young man, we decided that we're not going to let them get away with it. We're going to get some of that food. So they picked me up and lowered me into this open-top closet, and I picked up all the goodies that we were supposed to get, such as jelly and oranges and cookies and whatever, and I handed it out to them, and we got it back, and this is how we got some of the food that we were supposed to get.
What happened in Warsaw? In other words, somebody wanted to convince your mother to pay them to treat you?
That's right. They invented all kinds of diseases for us. First of all, we didn't live at a hotel. We couldn't afford to stay at a hotel, so they had these like bed and breakfast places that we have here. We slept on the floor for as long as we were in Warsaw, which I think was about 10 days. I don't know how long we were there. We had no beds. They laid out these people who rented their homes to the immigrants. They laid out mattresses on the floor, and we slept on them. I don't know how much my mother had to pay for that accommodation, but this is how we stayed. And every time my mother went to a doctor, we had to get papers, certificates for the eyes and ears and whatever else. She was told that we had all kinds of diseases and we'd have to be treated for it, which
did
wasn't.
She believe it?
She did not, and she didn't follow through. And we started out for the port, and that's how we got there. And it was not necessary. We were fine. We were wonderful. But everybody tried to make money on the immigrants that were going to America.
I just want to mention about Warsaw. This place that we finally landed, where Shirley said we slept on the floors, and there were some people that slept in beds. They must have had more money, or they came before us, and they wouldn't relinquish the beds. So we stayed on the floor. My cousin Rose thought this place was so awful that she made up a song, and she called this place the Hotel Nassen. She says, Hotel Nassen's an unge kimmen, yo, unge kimmen. She made this up, and to this day I remember it.
Could you say, is that the whole song?
May have been more, but this is all I can remember.
And what does it say?
It's Yiddish. It says, in Hotel Nassen. Nassen means give me. Give me. We came to this place. Yo, yo, ungekimmen. Yes, yes, we came to this place. Uh-huh. Rose had a wonderful imagination. She was a
woman with an imagination, and she was inventive. And she should have been something other than what she did in her lifetime. Her wish and her hope was to be an actress, but that was not what she was, and was never encouraged into it. Her parents, certainly her father, didn't discourage her greatly, and it was in those days it might have been a lot easier to get into the movies or the theater, because the competition wasn't as great as is it now, and in New York was the hub of this type of work. But she was always really, how shall I say, she was being made fun of.
Ridiculed.
She was ridiculed because she wanted to be in the theater, and that's where she should have been.
Can you remember any other instances of being cheated as immigrants?
Yes. Not really, because if there was more cheating, perhaps the older people would have remembered, but I don't remember that. I do remember one thing, however, on the trip. It was a very long trip to Rotterdam from where we started in Austral. Many, many weeks, I think it must have been. And we slept on the in all the stations, waiting for trains for hours, in depots. And once in a while, my mother and my aunt, too, she was traveling with us, my Aunt Esther, she with her children, my cousins, they would buy something for the children. And once they bought a coconut cream pie with a lot of soft stuff in the middle. And they bought this pie for us, for the children. There were so many of us, Kenan Hora. But David, not knowing that the pie was on a chair, he sat right down on that pie, and everybody was licking his behind. And that's true.
Yeah.
David was one of those, shall I say, temperamental artists? No, not quite. He was a
clown. He really was a comedian.
He was a clown.
Yeah.
Even in those days.
Yeah.
But particularly later, he was a clown. He had such crazy novel ideas, which we went along with. Everything David said, we did. And so this particular time, it was one of those places where we had to wait for a train for many hours. And I was sleeping, and I got up to find out that that's what happened. I couldn't believe that we lost that pie in such a terrible way.
Do you know how it was decided that your Aunt Esther and your cousins would leave at the same time you did?
Well, yes, because my Aunt Esther depended on my mother a great deal. She loved her dealer. She was her sister-in-law. They were sisters-in-law. But somehow, in this country, the connotation sister-in-law or mother-in-law has a very funny meaning. You know, something isn't right. You know, your mother-in-law, you know, mm-hmm. quotation. But they were sisters-in-law, but they were really very loving, and they loved each other, and they were like sisters. And my Aunt Esther depended a great deal on my mother because my mother was, I don't know, she was able to do things. Yeah, she had a lot of...
She was very aggressive, and she was independent.
And she was an independent woman. She was able to do things. My Aunt Esther was not able to do anything. She couldn't accomplish too much. She was sort of a sickly woman.
Well, now, did her husband send money
at the same time? Yes, so he did. He sent money at the same time. So they made arrangements to travel together. Because they loved each other and they wanted, and we all loved each other and we wanted to travel together, and that's what we did. And my mother got all the papers for everybody. She got all the visas. She got all the accommodations. She.
Okay, we're stopping here for telephone. Okay, we're resuming again after telephone.
Yes, and I just, Shirley was talking about our trip with our cousins, with our beloved Aunt Esther. Aunt Esther was a wonderful person. This is truly from the heart. She loved people. We loved her. She understood everything, and she was such a kind woman. She was a wonderful mother. Madeline, each time she talks about her mother to this day, there are tears in her eyes. And we really felt very close to her as well as we did to the rest of the family. Now, talking about David, Nat wants me to tell the story. When we were very small, and David was very small himself, we had a death of a bird in our court. A little bird died, and David said, "Let's make a funeral. And let's have a burial." He carried the bird somehow in a box, and we all marched together behind him, and he dug a little hole someplace near his house.
Yeah.
And we all cried about the bird, and we buried the bird, and we thought it was a very honorable way of disposing of the body. One day, David says, you know, I wonder what happened to the bird in there. So we dug the bird up, and we were shocked to see the cavity filled with worms. And that's the last time we'll ever do that again.
And I want to tell you what effect that this thing had on me. That years and years later, when I was married, and my husband and I went to an affair and his family, and they served, what's that chicken from?
With wild rice.
Yeah, Cornish hen with wild rice. I cut open the little Cornish hen, and I saw the wild rice, and I never could eat it because it reminded me of the worms and the cavity of that bird.
And strangely enough, David, who was our cousin, he and we were doing things together, whereas I don't recall that he ever did this with his own sisters and brother.
No.
Just with us. So we really miss David a great deal for many, many reasons.
Okay, let's see. Ellis Island. How long did you have to stay there?
I reckon, I sound like a Westerner, I think that it was no less than 12 days due to all that reason for my father being sick in the hospital, had still not been discharged, and then we had to get a bond. And it took a long time to get a bond. Finally, there was this bond, and we were released. But the experience in Ellis Island, I think we had that on the first tape, was the most unpleasant. We bore it all. We had to stand and wait for a cot or some sort of sleeping arrangement, which were just the coil springs, nothing else. There were no mattresses on the beds. And Shirley and I we knew they would open the doors at a certain hour. We wanted to be first to get the beds. So we stood in front of that door, and people piled up behind us. And when they would open the doors, finally, there was so much pushing and so much shoving. And we ran. Being small and children, we were able to run fast. And we were able to get a couple of, she lay on one, I lay on the other, and the other, when the rest of the family came, my mother and the small children, we shared those two coil match springs as beds. And this went on for the length of time that we were there. So Ellis Island is not a pleasant place to look back on. However, it was a wonderful sight when we finally came to it and saw the Statue of Liberty, and we felt that the journey was over and we would finally land, have our feet on the ground. So Ellis Island, though not a pleasant experience, it is a life experience and something that we had to live. And I don't know whether, Shirley, you want to say anything about Ellis Island?
Well, nothing. I think you've covered it pretty well, except this, unless Janet wants us to repeat the story about Mama and that woman from where they had the incident about the seat. We had no seats. We were in a big room in Ellis Island. There were a lot of people, all the people who had to be there, in one big room. We didn't have a place where to sit. We sat on the floor, or there was a bench without a back. But there were some seats near the windows facing the ocean that were occupied by other people, and so we didn't have any. But one woman got up, and she must have gone to the bathroom. So my mother noticed that there's a seat near the window. She went over to sit down and rest her back a little bit for a while. When that woman came back, she said to her, "Get out of that seat. That's my seat." She was a different language.
She was Italian.
She was an Italian woman from she was a Sicilian, I think. And she said to her, you know, to get out of the seat. My mother understood what she meant, but she said, "I'm sitting here now." Well, if my mother didn't get up quickly enough, she pulled out a knife and was going to stab her unless she relinquished that seat. So that was one of the things that we had to live through. And I remember when we came to Ellis Island before we left for America, my mother made me a very beautiful coat. I should come in looking like a somebody. She made me, it was like a military blue double-breasted coat which some seamstress made up for me, and Lillian and I had dresses alike, red plaid dresses, and I had that dress and the coat to wear over it. Well, while we were there in that room, I didn't have to wear a coat, so I must have left it lying somewhere. And before I knew it, somebody had stolen it. And it just broke my heart. This brand new coat that I was so proud of, that my mother had made for me, was stolen. And so, of course, I don't remember too much about the food in Ellis Island. The only thing I remember is the first time I ate breakfast, they served me cornflakes with hot milk. And the cornflakes melted into the milk, and it was like brown mud, and I couldn't eat it. But otherwise, I don't remember any of the food that we had there. Do you?
I remember only the first night where we had the hamburgers. And there were two dining rooms. One was for kosher, and one was not kosher. But being greenhorns, we didn't know which was which, and we went into the one that was non-kosher. And we were served hamburgers, and not knowing that it wasn't kosher, everybody was eating. But since I myself was not feeling well, I wasn't eating anything. And the man next to me on my left was really looking at that, longingly at my hamburger, which wasn't being eaten. I asked him whether he wanted a hamburger, and he said yes, so I gave it to him. But later, when I found out that this was not a kosher dining room, I was so happy that I had not eaten an unkosher hamburger.
How did you feel? What did you do during the days? All those long days.
Yeah, those are the days that we did very little. First of all, we were not allowed out. I think we were locked in, but they did have the very large doors that I can recall only one time. They opened up those doors to the water. We could see
the.
It was like a loading platform, I think, because you could walk out on the loading platform, but not any further. And we could get some air from there, but just the one day. I'm sure there was never another day. But what we did, nothing. The only time that we did do something was the day that I became eligible to go up to the playroom. They did have a playroom for children. And how I became eligible, I don't know, but I did become eligible, and I went up there to play. They had a game room. They had dolls, and they had other toys with which to play. And the person who was there in charge gave me a little flannel dress. This little dress became my joy, my delight. I had never had a short dress. This was a dress way above my knees, and I loved it. Up to that point, everything was below my knees and very long, because it had to be handed down to the next person, the next child. This little dress, I don't know what happened to it to this. Of course, it's many years since, but I wish that I had been able to keep it and hold on to it for memory. That I think it must have been given away eventually, because when we moved to Henry Street, I never had it anymore. So my aunt, that's another thing. When we came to this country, there was a belief that everything we came with had to be thrown away, and everybody had to get citrus magnesia. And I had to drink citrus magnesia. It was horrible. But that's what they thought needed to be done with people who came as immigrants. I don't know where that came from, but we had to do it. I remember drinking that milk, not milk, citrus magnesia. It is awful.
It was the idea of simply
cleansing us.
And clothes, too. They had to give everything away. They gave away my other things, all my other things. I didn't have too much, but whatever we came with, I don't know what happened to it, so they must have given it away. And that little dress, they didn't know that was an American dress, or I would have been able to keep it. They thought I brought it probably from Poland, and they gave that away, too, I guess. I can only guess, because I really don't know what happened. Nothing was left. So that's it. I mean, but Ellis Island, that's one good memory I have of Ellis Island, that playroom with this lady who was in charge. As I said on the first tape, I think she was from the Red Cross, although I'm not sure if they operated out of the Ellis Island at that time.
Maybe social workers.
But that's the one good thing that I remember about Ellis Island, like having to go up there for the afternoon and play. It was pleasant then, but that's all. The other things that stand out very much in my mind are those waiting for those cots, for those...
We really didn't have much to do in Ellis Island. It was a very boring time. We just sat around. There was nothing. They didn't do very much for the people who were sitting there all day long.
Well, the thing is, I don't think people spent as much time as we did. They came and they went. That's the reason why they didn't have much for anything for anyone to do. They didn't realize that there were four children there for 12 days, and we had nothing to do there. They should have certainly had a teacher or somebody. But that was 1921, and I guess things were different in those days.
Can you say any more about the difference in clothing from the United States and what you wore?
I can remember some things. In Europe, we had very little clothing. When it was very cold, we had no coats. We used to call it a déralé. It was a sort of a Balbriggan shawl. It was supposed to be warm, but how warm can it be when it's very cold weather?
It was like a woolen stole. That's what it really was.
That's all we had.
Yeah.
And we also had some kind of very warm shoes, the volaques.
Yeah.
I didn't have them. Some people had them.
Did I have them?
David had them.
Yeah, I think I had
David
them.
David had all kinds of sores on his feet when we were traveling.
Yeah.
From the cold, frostbitten. It was very cold where we were. It was on the Russian, very close to the Russian border. It was very cold where we were. But however, even with the little derala which we wore, I went to school that way. And the day that I described on the first tape, where I went to school and there was such high snow and it was so very cold, but I wouldn't miss school. We got there. When I got there, the school was not open. It was closed, and I had to come back. It was quite a trip to go to the school. It wasn't around the corner. It was a long distance. For me, it seemed like a long distance. And I came back, and my hands were so frostbitten, I remember crying and feeling so much pain because I was so cold, and my hands were all frostbitten from the pain. I guess this is why I was crying. I do remember the clothing. The clothing that I had there, as I said before, if I had a dress, it was down to my ankles, maybe. When I came here and they gave me that little dress, I loved it so. So the clothing was different. Here we didn't even have sweaters. We had no coats, no sweaters, no nothing. I don't know if other children had it, but we didn't. And I don't know.
I remember our father sent me a sweater. It must have been from Morris's factory. His cousin Morris Bloom had a knitting factory. He made all kinds of knitted things. Later on in life, after I was married and had a child, I remember going to his factory, and he gave me some suits, you know, knitted suits, like a two-piece dress or whatever. But I remember my father sent me a blue sweater, which I wore in the winter. It was a little thin sweater. It was something that I would wear here, like the top over my shoulders. But I wore it during the winter time for warmth, going to school. I don't remember any clothing that we had. I just don't remember.
Do you remember shoes?
I was going to say about the shoes. In the summertime, we wore no shoes. Barefoot. Everything was barefoot. And if I don't remember having shoes. I think once or twice my mother did get us shoes for Passover.
Yeah.
I do recall that.
With the high laces.
With the buttons.
Buttons and high laces.
Yeah, laces and buttons and whatever it was.
It was
very pretty.
Beautiful. She had them made. Those shoes were custom made for both of us. The two older children got. And if the shoes got small later on, another child had them. So we had those high shoes up to about mid-ankle at least, you know, mid-calf at least. And they were with buttons and then laces all the way up. They were beautiful.
Yeah, I loved them. Yeah. However, those Shirley said they were made to order. They had to be. There was nothing sold that's ready made. Dresses, shoes.
Everything had to be made.
To order.
Linens had to be made.
To
everything.
Order. Everything. There were no stores that sold these things like they do in this country. You have all kinds of competition.
You made it yourself, Mom.
Oh, Nat wants to. I had told him the story. Well, that was
not
very
important.
Nice. It was. Why?
Just because you traveled to another town.
It was in the same town. It's a story about we went to. Right. This was after. This was right before we came to this country where we had those lovely little dresses that were made by Fage.
Yeah.
You remember?
Yeah.
And there was a wedding. Leia got married. And
my aunt Esther's sister, younger sister, got married. So, of course, whoever lived in it, all the family was invited. Everybody, all the relatives were invited.
So my mother was invited to take two children, and we went. I guess you didn't have to get an invitation when someone got in the family got married. You just assumed that you would be there. And my mother took Shirley and me. She must have felt very good about that. And now we have klezmer here now. Now in this country, klezmer music.
Klezmer music, you must have heard of that. Uh-huh. Yeah.
They had klezmer at that wedding playing music. And if you wanted a dance, you had to pay. So my mother paid for Shirley and me to dance. We had learned a very beautiful dance from my aunt Malke.
Yeah.
Several beautiful dances, and my mother wanted to show us off, I guess. And we went to this wedding, and we did this dance solo. So that's
just the two of us, the patch dance we did.
Whatever it was. It,
yeah.
Yeah.
Patch? Patch dance.
The one, too. Okay, so that's what the story that Nat wanted us to tell. I guess he enjoyed that one.
Okay. So do you remember things about being in America that struck you as different when you first arrived? I know it was a tumultuous time, but that were different and that you had not been used to. Any things that struck you about this country?
Well, when we came and we finally were taken out of Ellis Island, and we explained to you how we got out, that a bond had to be put up. No one in the family had enough money to put up for the bond, so my uncle arranged with his boss, who was very kind and very understanding, and took a chance on us, and he put up the bond so that we would not be a public charge, and so we were able to come out. And as we explained to you before, the family was broken up and went to different places to live. The most amazing thing to me was, first of all, what the streets looked like, and we were taken into an elevated train. I think it was the
Third Avenue L,
and we never saw anything like it, and we got deathly sick on it because from the motion and the whole thing, she got sick and I got sick. We had to get out on the station because otherwise we would just throw up, you know, in the train. We couldn't take it. But really, actually, when we got here, we were in such a dither. We were so mixed up. We didn't know where we were. Mm-hmm. Everything was different. There wasn't anything that we were accustomed to at all. Everything was so big, and the streets and the trolleys and the elevated train. Everything was different to us. We could not possibly imagine anything like that.
I remember being struck very hard by the amount of food that I saw on the tables in wherever we were. I remember even going to where you were staying at the Blooms, and Cousin Bertha put out so much food. I had never seen so much food. cheeses and rolls and bagels and whatnot. I said, my goodness, this is very wonderful food. Rich people must live here. And also about the lights. So much light in the streets. I was very impressed with the lights. I remember going that one time to Aunt Esther's house when Mama had left me with Esther. Where were we? She left me with Esther in Uncle Joe's house. She took Sylvia. Shirley was already at the Blooms. And she went to visit my uncle and my aunt, Uncle Schmilke and Aunt Esther, to the Lower East Side while we were still staying in the Bronx. And so I said to Esther, come on, I think I know how to get there. Mama went, but she didn't take us, but I think we'll go anyway. And I took my sister Esther, who was younger than I, and I said, we'll go see what's over there. And she said, okay. So I took her, but at that time you had to have a ticket to go into the elevated. You had to have money to pay, buy the ticket, and go through. Children, I think, were free, but you had to have an adult, and there were no adults. My mother had gone, so I waited for some adults to come along, and I said, when I saw some adults going, I said, this is the time, let's go. And we went right through, and I saw the man standing at the other side, at the turnstile, and he was smiling. I wonder if he knew what was going on at Canal Street. I got off that train, that elevator, Canal Street. I got off that light, that elevator. I was impressed with the lights. There were so many lights. It wasn't the daytime, but lots of lights were still on. And when we must have gone home, I was very impressed with the lights. The lights struck me as being so different. And the streets, of course, so crowded. We hadn't seen so many people. And while we lived in Ostrov, we had just a few people around most of the time. But here, the streets were teeming with children and adults. And it was to me, that was a lot of a difference. The lights, the streets, and especially the food. The food was very impressive. By Bertha.
Yeah.
Very impressive. She had lots of food.
Well, they were well-to-do people, really. You know, he was a manufacturer.
I didn't see this kind of food even at Becky's.
And I stayed with them. And I remember one time he took me and his daughter, May, to the Capitol Theater. And that really... I was like mesmerized when I got in there. The beauty of the place, it was like a palace. I know that you probably were never in there, but had you ever been in Radio City? Well, this was more beautiful. The Capitol Theater was much more beautiful. It was very elegant and very, with the portieres of velvets and lights and chandeliers and mirrors. I think I walked into one of the mirrors because I did. He took the two of us on a Sunday afternoon to the Capitol, the movie and whatever else. I don't remember what the movie was about. I'm sure I didn't understand it because it was in English. But he took in his car, in his automobile. He took us downtown, from the Bronx to the Capitol Theater on 51st Street. It was very beautiful, very impressive. Yeah.
But they were rich, because I can only gauge that by the amount of food, that wonderful food. Delicious.
Was it your uncle?
Delicious.
Was it your uncle, your Aunt Esther's
husband
whose boss put up the bond?
Yes, yes. This man that I lived with was my father's cousin, this Morris and Bertha Bloom. Mm-hmm. They had two children. They had a daughter, May, and a young child, Teddy. They were young people.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any instances about learning English? Any particular experiences in the process of learning English?
I don't remember the process of learning, but all of a sudden I was able to speak. And I didn't seem to have any problem with it at all. In fact, it came so quickly and so suddenly that the principal of PS1, she wanted to speak to me and see me. What happened? And she couldn't believe that I was an immigrant of short time.
Any idea how long it was before? Well, roughly, do you have any idea how long it was before?
Well, it might have been maybe before I graduated. I was 2 years in that school, PS1, and then I graduated. So it may have been maybe close to my graduation. I don't remember. But she was so impressed and so... she couldn't imagine how quickly I learned to speak. She says, she told me, I think her name was Miss
Wilson,
and she said, I can't believe that you're here in this country so short time. And that's when that Miss Williams, she wanted to talk to Miss Williams why I was getting bad marks in her class. But that Miss Williams, she was a real anti-Semite. She was a real witch. First of all, she was a woman with gray hair, tall and heavy, and she never should have been a teacher, because it was a neighborhood, a very mixed neighborhood that we lived in. That PS1 was in a neighborhood where there were Italians, Jewish, Greeks, Chinese, all nationalities lived in that neighborhood. In the building that we lived, our next door neighbor was Chinese. The ones across the hall were Greeks. Mm-hmm. And we had Jewish people and everything. In the school, my class at that time had 7 Jewish girls, and the rest of them were of mixed background, mostly Italian.
This is in Henry Street?
On Henry Street, 37 Henry Street. And I was really very bright, and I knew my work. I had caught on to the arithmetic, and I was an outstanding student. And in every subject, really. And this teacher, Miss Williams, called on me one time, and I knew she didn't like me. So whenever she called on me, I got very nervous. And she asked me to describe, you know, the boundaries and how it flowed, you know, the boundaries and how it flowed, east or west or whatever. Well, I got up, and I got very nervous, and I started to describe the Mississippi River instead. So she said to me, sit down, Lieberman. I wish you were there.
You see, that's the difference.
Those are the things we had to live through.
And that's the difference between my teachers, whom I remember with a great deal of affection, that first one who was called Miss Reese, and the second one who was called Mrs. Dunkel. And she was a doll. This was on the 3B. I was already 6 months in this country when I had Mrs. Dunkel. She was a wonderful, wonderful teacher, and I think everybody felt this way about her. She was a good woman, a wonderful woman, and loving to all the children. In our class, there were just 4 Jewish girls, and the rest, about 28, were of a different origin or ethnic group. And there are good teachers. I just don't want Shirley to give the impression that all of them were bad.
In that same school, I had Miss Adler, who was wonderful.
That's true.
And other teachers who were great, but this woman never should have been a teacher, because she certainly didn't know how to deal with children, especially a foreigner, an immigrant, who was doing so well. And the principal was so proud of me, and she treated me this way. It was very painful to me.
Learning English for me was probably different. First of all, when I was at Miss Reese's class, I was told to go down to the yard, and there was another teacher there, and they had cards that she held up cards. I don't know what they said on the cards, but I was supposed to learn from that, I think. I don't know. And I went to that. To that area in the school, the PS40, maybe for a couple of weeks, but I don't know what it was supposed to be for. But we learned as time went by, reading, and it didn't seem to be as hard as it is for older people. I think children adapt much quicker, learn much faster, and it was not hard at all. I think when we moved to Henry Street, by that time we were here through. I was able to speak pretty well, yes, and I think you were too.
Yeah.
Now, in your school then, were a lot of the children immigrant children?
No.
They were of different ethnicities, but they had been born here.
It was a mixed neighborhood, but everybody got along fine. Everybody was lovely. We had no problem with other religions, none at all. I remember the girls in my class, they were a lot older than I was. They were girls who were young women, and but they weren't they were very troublesome to the teachers, especially one I remember was very bad, and she gave the teacher a lot of trouble. She was unruly. So the teacher made her president of the class, and after that she was fine, and she graduated. They finally got rid of her.
No, the teachers were very nice at PS1. It's the oldest school in the city.
Yeah.
And
I don't know if it's still in existence.
I think it still is.
Yeah.
Still is, right. They may have made some changes. But
it's on Henry Street.
This was our we lived in Henry Street and for my first Christmas. That was the first Christmas. By that time, we were here 9 months. No, even more than that, close to a year. But yeah. I was still with Mrs. Dunkel. And I remember that the children, they were going to have a Christmas tree, and I had not known what that was. And the children brought in these toys for the Christmas tree that broke very easily.
No, the decorations.
What do they call those?
Ornaments.
The ornaments?
Yeah.
And I was intrigued by that, as fascinated by what are those things. I never saw them before. And eventually, I guess I must have understood that this was for the Christmas tree. And Mrs. Dunkel gave us presents for Christmas. Each child got a table in a little box. It was a table and chairs, four chairs, wooden chairs and a wooden table. In a little box, they all fitted under. And it was such a nice thing for her to have done. And she didn't know about that. So that was it.
Okay, so how...
So that was it.
Okay, so how about socializing, like your parents? Did they join social clubs, or how did they simply, like your mother, was she simply with the other family, the cousins and your aunt and all that, or were there like social clubs that the adults belonged to?
Well, there was a club at the Madison House. It was called the Mother's Club, and it was run by a Mrs. Dorf, or something like that. I don't think that was Dorf, but anyhow, that was the only club that my mother belonged to. The socializing was done with the family, my uncle Schmilke and his wife Esther, and that was all the socializing. There were others, and then there was some from Europe, and they getting to get some sort of on a Saturday night or a Sunday afternoon, but mostly Sunday afternoon, but mostly it was
but once in a while they used to have like a big ball, but from a sort of a ball. All the people that came from our town used to organize like a dance, you know, and so my mother would go and would take me and her, the two older children. I don't know what she did with the younger ones.
Would there be a lot of people from
Yes, there were a lot of people there from Ostrava. I didn't know
them. Well,
we were
grown by then, I think.
Yeah, we were more grown.
Yeah.
But I didn't know them. It was my mother who knew all these landslides, you know. And she used to take us. But most of her social life was with the family. It was... I don't remember. Some landslide used to come
up.
Yankel,
Yankel Green used to come.
And his wife.
Yes, and they would come mostly to Aunt Esther's house.
Yeah.
And that was a social activity. But also she used to go to the Jewish theater.
Right.
She loved the Jewish theater.
I went with her.
And I went to the Jewish theater a few times myself. And my mother used to tell us about Jenny Goldstein, who was an actress then, and
tearjerkers.
Yes.
Time.
Right.
Would they be about Europe? Would they be about the old country?
No, dramatic stories, you know, but real tearjerkers, really when you had to cry, otherwise you didn't enjoy the show.
Yeah, I think so. I think you really had a good time, and if you were able to have a drama like that to make you feel very bad.
Now, how did your mother feel about coming here?
Well, her husband sent for her, so she was ready to go. He had been away for 7 years during the time of the war, and until things got settled, we had no communication with him during the war, no mail, nothing. So really, he was far removed from her, too. 7 years, a long time for separation. So when she came, she was ready to go, and she made all the arrangements to go, and we got here. First of all, I think, first of all, my mother was 34 when we came to this country, wasn't she? She already had 4 children, and my father probably was the same age, and he was here alone for 7 years, a young man. So if he had some affairs here, I don't blame him. He had to have some sort of release.
But I do blame him for lack of responsibility
I mean, he knew, he sent for a family, he should have been ready to accept us and make a home for us. What he did before we came, I don't want to know, and I forgive him. But he should have made a home for us when we came.
No, he wasn't nice at all. He was very unnice. I recall the trip to the hospital the first time, where he was still there, and my where my mother was staying with my father's cousins. Their name was also Bloom, but B-L-U-M, it was a different Bloom. And they took my mother and me and perhaps you, I think you were there too, to visit my father who was still in the hospital. And this was the first time that my father saw us after these many years of separation. And I can still remember when he walked toward us, we were walking toward him. He was already ambulatory. And what he said, "I'll be right back." He did not embrace my mother. He did not embrace me. And he surely did not embrace you, because he walked right out. And I thought, this is later, of course. At that time, I didn't really remember him. I did not know who he was even. I didn't really care. But later, when you think about it, in retrospect, my God, how do you do such a thing? You haven't seen your wife for so long. And she went through so much during the war. You haven't seen your children for so long. What kind of a father, what kind of a husband are you? This is how I thought later. And I think I still feel this way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, how about your mother? After it was clear that she wasn't going to be reunited with your father, was she happy in this country? Did she adapt, adjust?
Well, she made the best of a very terrible situation. I mean, we all try to help. My uncles and try to patch things up, but they were not doing it right, doing it properly. They
were not diplomatic.
They didn't know.
They were not psychologists.
They didn't know how to behave in such a. They sent me as the oldest child to talk to my father to come, to join the family. I could not speak to him. First of all, I didn't remember him. I was a young child when he left. I was only 13 when I came, and I could not. Every time I tried to talk, I got hysterical. They put me through this terrible ordeal all the time. I don't know, it was such a traumatic thing for me. To ask me to talk to my father, he should come back to us. I could not speak to him. And of course, my mother was also terrible. She didn't know what to do. What is she going to do? Here she is in a strange country with 4 children. It's a terrible time. She wasn't prepared to make a living or anything.
Did she work at some point, your mother?
She couldn't work. She had 4 children. Like I explained to you, we took home work.
Yeah.
So we all worked on it. Mm-hmm. Children, everybody.
Yeah, she took home lots of things from factories that were given out to be done at home. It paid much less than they paid very little to the people who were in the factories. But you can imagine how much they paid the people who were out of the factory.
Yeah, this was the time of the sweatshops.
Right. And Shirley was talking about my father and how she had to plead with him to come back to us and make a home for us. And I remember that he was judged to support us. The amount I subsequently read in the decree was $6 a week, a month, or a month,
week,
I think, for
a week.
for a child, per child. Yeah. No, I don't think it was a month. It was not a week. In those days, $6 a week would have been a lot of money, $24 a week. I don't know. Perhaps it was. But anyhow, he was negligent about sending it. Maybe he didn't even know how to send it. Maybe he didn't even have a checking account at that time. Or maybe whatever.
I'm sure he didn't have a checking account. What was he going to get money to put in a checking
account? Right. Well, he was making a living. Yeah. But
I didn't know from things like
so my mother chose me to go collect the whatever he can offer. And he lived as a boarder in an apartment where he had just one bedroom, I presume, and there was a woman there who was the owner of the apartment, the lessee, I guess. Anyhow, I would go and have to wait for him. I sometimes stayed outside, and if the weather was bad, the woman who lived in the apartment, whose landlady she was to him, she would tell me to invite me to come in to sit and wait for him inside the house. And I did that on occasion. When he would finally arrive after me sitting there for so long, he would take the money out of his pocket, hand it to me without a word, and I couldn't wait to leave. And this is how you asked whether my mother worked. We used to get some money from him, and my mother maybe got some help from her brothers. Joe would come over with some food occasionally. He had a delicatessen store, and he would bring some canned foods, and whatever my father gave me is the way we were able to manage. Mm-hmm. It was not the best way, but that was the way it was. And my impression of that time was simply awful. My father was not a father as a human being should have been.
Mm-hmm. was your mother's spirit? Your mother sounded so spunky in the ways that she managed in Poland. Did that carry over to the United States, or do you think because of the language barrier and all that had happened that it was that she changed somehow?
No, she didn't. She tried in every which way, like mm-hmm. I told you.
Well, how about the candy store?
Yeah. After we lived on the east side.
Yeah, and we were living in Henry Street when she got in touch with Gussie.
Yeah.
And they both went into business. And
we had a candy store.
In the Bronx again.
Yeah.
On Brook Avenue.
Right.
Now I think it's probably a very depressed neighborhood, but in those days it was not. And that's how she tried. It didn't work very well. That's how she tried. It didn't work very well. The candy store was not a good, was a flop. It didn't make any money. So that's when we came back to the Lower East Side at Madison Street, at 212 Madison Street, next door to my aunt and uncle. But she worked at the Madison House. At the Madison House, there were things that could be done. They served lunches at times. My mother helped out with that. And they served box lunches when we would go on picnics or outings. And she would help do that. So she made a few dollars that way. And again, there was homework. We took the work into the house and we all helped. There were ties that we used to work on. There were even pants.
Belts we made.
Oh, all kinds of things.
Yeah.
So this was the way it was. And of course, as we grew older, we went to work. And I went to work and made $6 part-time when I was going to school. After school, I made $6 a week. I worked for Miss Kerr. She was an accountant. And I contributed the $6. I walked all the way from Broadway to 212 Madison Street. I walked to save the nickel car fare. That's what it was, because mm-hmm. we needed the nickel. And that's what I did. And in the summertime, I worked in a factory where they made greeting cards.
And how old would you have been then?
I must have been about 14 by that time.
Well, I worked part-time when I went to high school. I made $2 a week from 8 to 12. Then I'd run home quickly, have my lunch, and I had a late pass for school so I could come in, let's say, about a quarter to 1. They allowed me to come in. I made $2 a week. Filling tea bags, and of course summers I always worked. And then when I was 16, I had a full-time job from 9 to 5.
Well, before we close, because we're practically at the end of this tape, maybe each of you could say all of what effect all of what we've been talking about had on you for the rest of your life, once that you married and were adults, that your early life, how do you think that changed you, or what impression on you do you think your early life in Poland and also in the United States had on you later?
Well, naturally, our experiences early in our life had a great effect on us. But I don't think it harmed us, because we grew to love and to be loved. And I had a lot of experience at the Madison House with young people of my age, boys, girls. We learned to dance, and we forgot the trials and tribulations of the earlier years, because it was fun. I enjoyed it very much. We had so many things to do at the Madison House. We used to go on outings in the summertime, and in the spring we have races, and Madeline and I won the three-legged race, and we got medals. And life was wonderful in those days, though we lived on the Lower East Side without a bathroom, without a toilet, without all those things, but it didn't matter. And again, I say this. My father, I don't think that it made much difference at all in our lives, simply because we did not know any better. We had no experience with a father, so we did not miss that. And it did not affect our lives as far as our husbands were concerned or our sex life was concerned. We were able to function as very well as human beings. And as I said before, we learned to be in love, and we learned to love and then be loved, and it was really not bad at all.
Good. All right,
I'll
make it very short. The fact that we didn't have a father all our lives made no difference in our life. We didn't miss him. My mother and our family gave us enough love to last us a lifetime. We had a loving family. We had lots of love all around us. So it didn't really injure us at all that my father was so mean to us. We didn't need him.
Okay. Well, we're going to close here. I want to thank you so much. This is Janet Levine. I've been speaking with Shirley Ruffman and Lillian Levine, and I'm signing off. Just two full tapes.
Yeah.
Ready?
Interview.
I just want to say, Janet, it was such a pleasure to meet you, and it was so wonderful to have you, and you went out of your way, and you spent so much time. We appreciate it. You were wonderful with us at Ellis Island. You're lovely here, and we really, really got to know and like you very much.